recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
Hi there, folks. My name is Lynn. I'm your host for Talking Twilight Zone, and I am here with my terrific co-hosts, Bobby Neer, Robert, and Dave. Hi there, guys.
Yep. Gobble, gobble.
Gobble, gobble. Well, guys, Thanksgiving is upon us, and Bobby and I are looking forward to a terrific feast on Thursday. I'll be buying our turkey and whatever I need for all the fixings tomorrow. And then we'll spend the next couple of days recovering and moaning about how much weight we've just put on, but it is worth it. So I hope everyone else will be enjoying a wonderful Thanksgiving as well.
And while you're eating, you can put in Plymouth Adventure with Spencer Tracy. That's a nice little Thanksgiving movie.
Which one?
Plymouth Adventure, I think it is, with Spencer Tracy.
It's about
Mayflower. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Hey, that's cool. I was thinking, we don't have that, do we, Bob?
I don't think so, but I've seen it on TCM.
Bummer. Maybe they'll show it. Maybe they'll show it on Thanksgiving.
They might.
I'll have to check the Turner Classic Movies or something. They might show it that day. That'd be cool. Okay. Well, anyway, today's episode is titled "The Obsolete Man," and I'll turn it over to Robert for the opening clip.
And now, Mr. Serling.
Mr. Burgess Meredith is no stranger to the Twilight Zone, but his role in the story is a unique one even for him. The time will be the future, the place just about anywhere where men have been taken over by a machine state. Our story is called The Obsolete Man. It may chill, it may provoke, but we're rather certain it'll leave a mark. Twilight Zone, The Obsolete Man.
Thanks, Robert. And also I'd like to welcome Guest 5. Thanks for being with us, Guest 5. Okay, The Obsolete Man is about a futuristic society in which all books have been banned. It's also a society that claims to have proven that God does not exist, so religion has also been banned. That state, I guess it's whatever kind of state it is, that state and the chancellor for the state have passed judgment upon a librarian named Romney Wordsworth, claiming that he's obsolete and therefore must be liquidated, claiming that he can choose the method in which he dies. And the reason he's obsolete, of course, he's a librarian and books have been banned. But he's got to be liquidated and he can choose the way that he goes. So after the chancellor dismisses Wordsworth's arguments about how all human beings have a purpose and no one should be declared obsolete, Wordsworth accepts his fate and he makes 3 requests. He wants to be allowed to choose his assassin, and only that assassin will know the method of his death. And he wants to die with an audience at midnight the next day. So the chancellor, he's more than happy to comply. Then 45 minutes before Wordsworth's death, he invites the chancellor to his room and he traps him inside. He then reveals to him that a bomb will explode in his room at midnight, so he plans to spend the last minutes of his life reading the Bible aloud. A TV camera that was set up in the room is broadcasting everything. Now, the chancellor, he tries to act brave at first, but moments before the bomb's to explode, he completely breaks down and begs Wordsworth to let him out of the room in the name of God. Wordsworth says that he will set him free in the name of God. He lets the chancellor out within seconds of the bomb exploding. However, Wordsworth is actually the victor, because when the chancellor shows up for work the next day, he's told that because of his cowardice, he has disgraced the state, and he's now obsolete. So the loyal members of the state, they all surround him, and they tear him apart. Ah, yeah. This is the final episode of Season 2, and to me, it works beautifully for 3 reasons. Burgess Meredith, it's a great story, and Burgess Meredith. That's right. To me, it all begins and ends with Mr. Burgess Meredith. I will give a lot of credit to Fritz Weaver. He did an exemplary job in his role as a chancellor. However, the story is nothing without Burgess. And I'm sure everyone who's seen this episode knows what I'm talking about, and they'll most likely agree with me on this. There were some very memorable episodes in this, moments in this episode. Now, here's a man, Romney Wordsworth. He's committed no crime, but he's considered obsolete because he's a librarian, books are banned, and, you know, he's outlived his usefulness, according to the state. And it's interesting that they find Romney so useless because he's so intelligent, and he was also once a carpenter, so why not employ him within the offices of the state? He's obviously more intelligent than most of the people condemning him. And Romney also has many books in his room. And I think it's wonderful that he was able to keep his book collection under wraps for so long. I can't help but wonder, you know, how he did that. I can only, speculate that they checked on certain people and Romney somehow slipped through the cracks and got away with keeping his books. But when
probably into Burgess' man, time enough at last, probably, the way his character.
Yeah.
He wasn't outgoing
that
much.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he seemed like the type that stayed pretty much to himself, you know. And I just think that he managed. He got away with it, and he was lucky in that respect. But you know, when the state decided your number was up, that was it. But there's one particular moment and line in this episode that I truly love. Romney speaking to the chancellor and attempting to explain why he's locked him in the room, and then he tells the chancellor to sit down and says, "It's you and me and the great equalizer, for death is the great equalizer." Oh, my God, that's, like, so true. It doesn't matter. You, me, Bill Gates, Queen Elizabeth, Tom Hanks, anybody, you know, anyone you want to name, all the same once we're dead. Stardom and status really means nothing once you're 6 feet under. And there's nothing to distinguish one person from the other at that point, which Romney also mentions. I mean, yeah, your legacy may not be as memorable or exceptional as some other people's legacies, but really we're all the same once we're dead. And another interesting moment for me is when the chancellor mentions how old people are eventually of no use and must be eliminated. And what gets me is that he says this with such an arrogance that you have to wonder if this man even realizes that he too is going to grow old and useless. Fritz Weaver, he does do an excellent job in this episode, especially, you know, the part where he's slowly getting to his breaking point just 2 minutes before the bomb was to explode. And then when the chancellor was deemed obsolete at the end, I took that as a message that this totalitarian state would not survive for long because they would eventually kill off each member one by one. This episode is definitely one of the best the Zone has to offer and a perfect ending to the second season. Rod Serling wrote this. And once again, it shows the man's true genius. It's always stuck with me. This episode has always stuck with me through the years. And for that reason, it gets a classic rating from me. And I also, at this time, want to welcome Logan to the show. Thanks for showing up, Logan. And I'm turning this over to Robert right now.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. You know, I kind of got the picture of the scene up here. I'm on our site, and I was just looking over the picture. And, you know, what I wonder is, where did they find that big table at? They must have had to borrow that from some rich person or something, or it must be a big executive table or something, because that thing, shoot. From one end to the other? Wow.
I never thought of that.
Well,
that was huge.
And then the podium that the chancellor's standing on, I mean, it's just, you know, to give the state, you know, we're the big and you're the small and you look small to us type situation is what I glean from the picture. And, you know, of course, this is a pretty good story. I really enjoy this. I think this was better than the ending of season one by far. Season two had its ups and downs, like season one did, but I think season two has really improved itself. And as I said before, and I'll say on our next show, that season three is my favorite of the Twilight Zone. So very much looking forward to going to the next season.
Yeah, there's some good episodes in season three.
Yeah, most definitely. And well, with this one, finishing up season two, I mean, I really did enjoy, I mean, it's a look on society, future society, and as Dave has said, you know, they always like to do two stories out of one. Remember, Eye of the Beholder is another society situation with that one as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, we get some other social society features down the road as well. But, you know, as you say, Burgess Meredith, wonderful actor. I'm glad he was given so many roles in The Twilight Zone. I think the next time we see him again is in season 5, I believe. The Printer's Devil, I think, is the next time we see Burgess Meredith.
Yeah. He had the most. He had the most episodes. He was, as far as a star, you know, a lead character. He was in the most episodes.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, it's not just him as a character, but the story as well was pretty good. Like I said, very much the Big Brother approach with this one. I very much liked the way they had the scene set up with him in the room with the Chancellor, you know, Wadsworth with the Chancellor in there, and just kind of building up the suspense, very much like, you know, a Hitchcock film. One of the things that I did say we would mention today is about Alfred Hitchcock. We'll do that down the road here. But you know what? I brought a fan favorite back, and actually this person really liked this story too. So we asked Mr. Horst, what did you think of The Obsolete Man? And what did you think of the character of the story?
Yes, sir, I like it. Did what he had to do. But I would have done the same thing had I been in his hooves. Yes, sir, I would.
Wow. Okay, thank you, Mr. Horst. See, he enjoyed that story, too.
Ren and Stimpy's horse.
But getting back to the review here, I very much wish that he would have read from some other books. Well, I understand that he only has less than 40 minutes before the bomb goes off in the room. That's the whole purpose of bringing the Chancellor in and have him feel what he's going through as well, and to show the other people what he's really like. We're all human beings, and we're all not perfect, and you cannot make a perfect society on what they got built up in this story. So, you know, I wish he would have read from some other books as well besides the Bible. Nothing against, you know, the Bible. I think it's great. You know, he was reading 23rd Psalm and some other passages as well. But since, you know, books were banned and stuff like that in this society, it would have been nice that he could have read a few lines from a couple other books. But that's just a minor
thing. Well, you know though, why he did that. It was mainly because, you know, they were saying they disproved the existence of God. So he was actually doing this as, like, in-your-face type of thing, sitting there reading from the Bible after he says, you know, we have proven that God does not exist. And he says, well, you can't just eliminate God through an edict, you know. So that's why I think he was doing that, to just do an in-your-face kind of thing. And then, you know, as you saw at the end, in the name of God, let me out of here. So, you know, they were making a big thing about, you know, the God situation.
Yeah, because, you know, he's Wadsworth is a God-fearing man, and it's understandable that he would. But I think it would have been nice to get it out a little bit more, you know, read from some other passages from books. But that's just me.
It would have been appropriate, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he could have read some Buddhism. He could have read some poetry or something mixed in there that would have given the idea to people, because he had the camera. I mean, for that 44 minutes, he has the audience right there in his hands, and you know they're watching this going on, because, as you explain, you know, the next day, people turned against him for being a coward. And, you know, Fritz Reaver, I mean, wonderful actor, too, seems to have secondary roles in The Twilight Zone, but still, I think he makes the best with the character of the Chancellor. Like I said a few moments ago, very much a Hitchcock feel to it. Did have suspense, which I feel that's what they were trying to do with this story, is to build some suspense with it. Because you got the passing of the clock showing the time to when the bomb actually goes off. And just the tension building with the Chancellor of trying to get out of that room. And at the very last minute before the bomb goes off. But if I was the Chancellor, I would have stayed in that room and went up with him, just because of the fact. And, you know, he seems to be an intelligent man, and he should have figured out by the time he got out. I shouldn't be showing my face up to work the next day. I mean, it's very arrogant of him to do something like that, but I guess that's just the way the society was set up during that time. I mean, there were some long parts, some boring parts in this, but, you know, that can be overlooked over the entertainment of the story, which I quite liked. One of the things I brought up was Hitchcock, and what is interesting with this clip here is he kind of goes into a situation like we did with the room situation in this story. He uses as an example an auction house and the Cary Grant character being trapped in there, you know, only one way out through this person. So he explains that, and then he adds a little antidote. So this one, I think you'll really enjoy.
Of utilizing your materials to the fullest dramatic extent. Cary Grant is a photographer, so naturally he fends off his attacker with the use of photographic materials such as a flashlight. That's only because of the it's indigenous to him, but I always, as far as I possibly can, insist on using those elements that belong to the character and involve them in the action of the story. For example, in the picture North by Northwest, Cary Grant is trapped in an auction room. He can't get out except by one way, and that bidding, crazy bidding, you see. So he gets himself thrown out. But the essential point is, he is in an auction room, and you must use the auction room. Now, in the same film, there was a final sequence on the faces in Mount Rushmore. Well, there, due to the objections of the government, we weren't allowed to have any of the figures move over the faces. We were told very definitely that you could only have the figures down between the heads, because they said, this is the shrine of democracy. What I wanted to do, or was prevented from doing, in the same line of thinking, was to have Cary Grant slide down Lincoln's nose, then hide in the nostril, and then Cary Grant have a sneezing fit. Not Lincoln, Grant. Well, there's a typical example of utilizing your materials to the fullest.
Yep, and Hitchcock was correct on that. You make what you have. Yeah, his little antidote there with Mount Rushmore.
That was funny.
But yeah, you talk about the master suspense. Another thing they brought up with him was do you consider you do suspense or mystery? And he pretty much says, I do suspense. One film he did do a whodunit, but the majority of his pieces he did was suspense. And very much like this episode here, very much the build of suspense, and talking about society as well. Logan's Run was a good example of a society where you had to die before age 30, and trying to keep society in check there. Last show, we talked about what a real Martian police stand up, and one of the characters talked about Ray Bradbury. Another thing of Ray Bradbury's was Fahrenheit 451. Society in that one. It was a book and then turned into a 1966 film. Here's the trailer for that.
Fahrenheit 451. Ray Bradbury, America's leading science fiction novelist, wrote it. Julie Christie, Academy Award-winning actress of Darling and Dr. Zhivago, and Oscar Werner, winner of the New York Critics Best Actor Award, star in it.
We shall see each other again?
No, we shan't. Why pretend we shall?
Directed by internationally famous French director François Truffaut. And now, a rare privilege, candid scenes taken during the shooting of this exciting and suspenseful story of the world of tomorrow. Fahrenheit 451. Is there an idle moment between scenes? Press photographers are quick to take advantage. For the public, of course, the big news in Fahrenheit 451 is Julie Christie, an actress with that most precious commodity, the ability to create, project, and kindle a mood in the audience. Nuances, subtleties, delicate shadings that are a director's dream, and for viewers, a delight. In this film, Julie plays a dual role, portraying both the wife and mistress of Oscar Werner. Here she is as the wife.
I bought you a present to celebrate your... Oh, I forget what. Never mind. You like it? Isn't it lovely? You like it?
Yes, I do. Very much.
Isn't it smart? It's the very latest thing. Can I bring your other one away?
All right.
As the mistress, Julie Christie makes her greatest impact. Warm, generous, daring, she fires the imagination of her lover and leads him into the sort of adventure that makes Fahrenheit 451 unusual and exciting motion picture entertainment.
A wonderful picture, Fahrenheit 451. And
yeah, well,
just from hearing that, you hear the helicopters and the shotgun, I mean, the machine guns and all that. I mean, very much a futuristic society, you know, going downhill pretty much. And other ones as well. Soylent Green is a good one that's mentioned.
New York City in the year 2022. Nothing runs anymore. Nothing works. But the people are the same. And the people will do anything to get what they need.
This is the police.
What they need most is Soylent Green.
The supply of Soylent Green has been exhausted. Return to your home.
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
Detective Sergeant Thorne. He has a 2-year backlog of unsolved murders. Now he's on a case that must be solved. Saul Roth, Thorne's private library.
Hey, Saul!
A living book in a world without books.
Have some pencils. Courtesy of your next assignment. William R. Simonson.
Simonson. He was the first to learn the secret of Soylent Green.
They told me to say that they were sorry, but that you had become unreliable.
Saul Roth was the next to know.
How do we come to this?
And he chose to die rather than reveal the secret of Soylent Green.
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
Why did you set up Simonson?
I didn't.
Cheryl.
I see your hands.
Officially, she's furniture. She comes with the apartment. She belongs to the tenant.
How many times you been in trouble with the police, Cheryl?
Never.
Can't hear you.
Never.
Captain Hatcher. First, he wanted this case solved.
Simonson. What do you say?
It was an assassination.
Now, he just wants it closed.
Who bought you? High and hot, and they want this case closed permanently. Their way. Now, you sign this.
You sign it!
Thorne refuses to close the Simonson case.
Just do what you have to do.
Where did you go with Simonson?
He took me to church.
Church?
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 6 months since my last confession.
Charlton Heston, Edward G. Robinson, Chuck Connors, Lee Taylor Young, Brock Peters, Paula Kelly, and Joseph Cotton fight for survival and try to solve the most bizarre riddle ever to face mankind. The search for the secret of Soylent Green.
One that always comes to mind as well is 1984. John Hurt in that movie, George Orwell, based on George Orwell book, was a pretty good last movie for Richard Burton. Kind of very cerebral, but here's the trailer for that. Now, I wonder if Richard Burton actually understood what he was saying, because even though the movie visually is stunning, the words are kind of dry and ineffective in some points in that movie, but it was okay, 1984. And with that look on society...
I said the book was very good.
Oh, yeah. Animal Farm was, I think, a requirement in school.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember
another
we read
classic,
that when
yeah.
I was in school. I originally gave it a 4 out of 5, but since we changed our rating, and I'm not for sure if we changed it on that side, I think we changed it a little bit later on. Actually, I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Very wonderful story, looking back on it and rewatching it again. Very much overture of what a future society could be, and with the examples I give today. So With that, pass over to Bobby. Bobby.
And also, I'd like to welcome, I want to welcome Steve. We have Steve Law here and guest number six. Okay, go ahead, Bobby. Sorry.
Thank you very much, Robert. Well, The Obsolete Man is a very compelling episode, obviously. It's not only compelling, I think it's scary. Since you've mentioned several movies and novels and things in the past 15 minutes, when I was very, very, very young, I read 1984. And by the way, I think they completely ruined it as a movie, but that's another matter. I read that when I was very, very young, and it really scared the hell out of me. And actually, since then, I don't have much of an appreciation for horror movies, monsters, things like that, because I don't think those things are very scary. What's very scary is the state going berserk and taking over your life. And I think there's no comparison between that and science fiction or anything else. And so The Obsolete Man is a very scary vision of what might happen. Many, many things make it good. The two obvious things are Burgess Meredith, of course. And just like I used to say and I have said in the past, you can't really imagine Time Enough at Last without him in it. You can't imagine this without him in it. I've thought about other actors, and I can't imagine anybody else knowing it. It just doesn't fit at all. The other thing it has going for it, obviously, is the set design, which Robert already mentioned. I have no idea where they found a long desk in a high podium like that. I actually searched the internet this morning trying to find if there was a backstory somewhere about that, and I couldn't find anything. So I don't know. My suspicion is they simply built what they needed, because I've read several times that The Twilight Zone was a fairly expensive series for CBS to produce. And that probably cost them a good penny to make any of that. But that starts off the story, and that makes it frightening right from the very beginning. It's bad enough that the state can call you in and decide that you're no longer needed, no longer useful. But imagine going to that trial, or any trial if you want to call it that, and the minute you walk in the door, you see the judge towering above you. You'll know immediately that you have no shot at it at all. There's no chance you're going to survive. It's already over as soon as you walk in. So I really like that part of the episode. It immediately gets your attention, and you can see that the odds are stacked against this guy no matter what. It is, like I said, very, very frightening. And Burgess, I share the same feelings about Burgess Meredith that Lynn does. He has about him the thing I've always admired in certain actors, and that is that he doesn't look like anybody else. He doesn't talk like anybody else. He doesn't act like anybody else. There are many actors who are good at what they do then and today, but they're not unusual. And he was. When I was growing up, my favorite actors were people like Henry Fonda and Jimmy Stewart and Burt Lancaster, because nobody was like them. They talked differently than everybody else. They carried themselves differently than everybody else. And Burgess Meredith does that in a different way. I mean, he's much smaller in stature, obviously. But he makes you pay attention to him. So he really adds an awful lot to this episode. And all I know is that Burgess Meredith can't catch a break in this series. He does appear in it several times. In Time Enough at Last, all he wanted to do was read. And then when he wandered the deserted landscape and finally found a library, he ends up breaking his glasses, so he can't read. Now he's actually a librarian, and that gets taken away from him, too. So the poor man can't catch a break no matter what he does. He had a 60-year movie and television career, 60 years of acting. He acted almost up until the end of his life. He lived to be 89 years and 10 months old. And like a lot of actors, he was called in the communist or witch hunts of the 50s, so badly that he was out of work for 7 complete years. For 7 years, he couldn't get a job, which is really unspeakable. And but he adds a lot to the Twilight Zone. He's in other episodes, as we know. And they had him do the narration in the Twilight Zone movie. And had they put him in the movie, instead of having him just do the narration, it might have been a much better movie than it is. But getting back to this episode, it's very, very interesting, I think, all along the way. I didn't find any boring parts to it, like Robert did, But that's because it's very short, and it plays out in 23 minutes, whatever it is, after commercials. I don't know that I would have felt the same way had it been an hour episode. It might have dragged on too much, but I think it's in the right place. Also, what I like about it is that it ends the season. It ends season two, something that The Twilight Zone does very badly on. I was looking before the show began at the list of Twilight Zone episodes by season, and they just didn't know how to end it. I mean, they ended season one with a terrible episode, and we all know how the series ends at the end. That's something I have trouble with The Twilight Zone. They tend to end seasons with lousy stories, which I think is a big, big mistake. You've got to give people a reason to come back the next season, even though it's already has a history behind it. When I watch a series week after week after week, you end the series on a bad note, I'm going to just think that you've run out of gas. That's it. You've got nothing more to give, and next season will be lousy. So this is, to me, of all the seasons, I think this is probably the best season-ending episode. This is what you really want to do. So I was very, very pleased about that. And I didn't find it boring at all, and it really, I think it is a very, very scary episode, to be honest with you. And I really can't see anybody else in it. If I want to nit, I gave it a 4.5 in ratings. I probably should have given it a 5. That's kind of nitpicking. But if I have any problem with it at all, and it really is a minor thing, it's in the ending, and that is the fact that you need a lot of suspension of disbelief here, because it's hard for me to believe that a state so all powerful that it can call a man in and tell him that his life is over because he's simply worthless and they don't need him anymore. It's hard for me to believe that that same state would give that person the option of how to die. I just don't see it. I think they'll tell you how to die. I don't see any purpose in that. Plus, the chancellor, as all-powerful as he appears to be, at least in the first half of the story, standing behind that podium and all, it's hard for me to believe that he would walk into an obvious trap and go over there. I mean, when he walks into Wordsworth's apartment there, he turns around right away and he locks the door behind him and he's looking the other way. That's pretty stupid. I would not in a million years would I walk into a trap like that, because you just told him he's going to die. And now you're going to go over and see him? I don't think so. So that was a pretty stupid thing to do, and you need a little bit of suspension of disbelief.
You know what else, though? Why didn't he just wrestle the key away from him? You know, that was another thing.
He didn't make any attempt at all.
He would have said, give me the key. You know, and he says, no, you grab the guy. And, you know, I mean, Burgess Meredith was a small guy. Fritz Weaver was big. You grab the guy and you get the key from him. I mean, he made no attempt, but I don't know, it was because there were TV cameras and he didn't want to, you know.
Nobody could come and rescue him, because that would have been giving in and showing people who are watching, you know, that the Wordsworth had gotten one over on them. But you're right.
Right,
I hadn't thought about that. At the very least, he should have.
Grab him and wrestle the key away from him, yeah.
Well, yeah, I agree. I think that was, he gave in a little bit too easily on that. So I think that a state that powerful would simply get rid of a person, and that would be it. But to me, that's the kind of story that really is scary. I mean, horror stories are fun. Psycho is certainly scary. And but I would rather see space aliens marching down the street than have the state come knocking at the door telling me that it was time to go. That's much scarier. Of course, as Americans, we don't think about that, because you go to bed every night and you don't worry that the state's going to come and get you, although maybe we ought to. So we really don't think about it. We're very secure. We worry about terrorists, but, you know, there is terror from within, too. So that, I think, is the best part of the entire story. Like I said, I gave it a 4.5. I think it is a classic. I don't know why. Like Robert, I'm not sure why I didn't give it a 5. That's a little bit of nitpicking. There really isn't anything wrong with it. But it's one of the best. And thank you for ending season two with that. By the way, Lynn and I watched this yesterday. We always watch them before we start a show. And on the DVD, at the end of it, Rod Serling comes on and he does a promo for the very first episode of the series. Where is everybody? Even showing a scene from it. And Lynn mentioned to me, why in the world are they doing that? Well, it's going into season three, not season one. And I had to go on the internet to see that they did that because they went into reruns. That's why at the end of season two, they went back to, apparently, I guess, back to season one and showed that. And that's why they did it that way. It seems kind of odd, but that's the only thing I could read on there, the reason why they did it that way. It looks a little strange. So I'll readjust my rating. And by the way, at our group, you can go back. All polls are always still open. You can go back and change your rating if you want to. And I'm
Yeah, Bobby, I went and checked that. I think that was the one where you did add the 4.5. So I changed it from 4 to 4.
Oh, I realize that. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah, some people said to me, can you make a few extra points in there? And that's what we did. But I may go back. Look, 4.5, 5, 5.5, 6, it doesn't matter. It's a classic episode, and it always will be. And really, truly, truly scary. Burgess Meredith is very much missed today. One more thing before I go about the set design. Imagine seeing that on TV today. You don't get any of that on television today. I'm always wailing about TV and how bad it is. You don't see any of that on TV today. Nobody bothers to do anything that makes you think or makes you feel a certain way. It's so drab and so dull and so repetitious that I really appreciate that they went through the trouble to do this. It's a classic for me. Okay, Lynn, that's it for me.
Okay, and now Dave. Let's hear from Dave.
Okay, well, yes, I certainly enjoyed it. And just picking up Bobby's point right there at the end, this is definitely an episode that works extremely well in black and white.
That
told trial scene is just made for it. And it reminded me in the way it was edited, or viewed, or lit by cameras, and I think Robert's already mentioned it, the Eye of the Beholder one. But one of the things that caught my attention a little bit with it was, as you mentioned, Burgess Meredith again back with books in this one. And as you say, I don't know how he managed to hide his little library. But of course, he brought out the Bible at the end. One of the things that struck me somewhat is that if you go back to an episode, I think it's from the season one, it might have been season two, A Nice Place to Visit, where the petty criminal thinks is in heaven. Apologies if this is a spoiler for anybody, but it turns out not to be that. But they weren't allowed to use the words heaven and hell within the episode, as far as we understood it when we reviewed it. So I was somewhat surprised that he was able to quote from the Bible. I'm not surprised that the Bible was there, but given the track record of they weren't even allowed to use words like hell and heaven, it seems strange. Perhaps
that's the only way you were allowed to use it. That's
right.
The only way they would let you do it.
Well, right. Maybe you could use heaven, but you couldn't say hell.
Okay.
Which is strange because later on down the road, there were episodes. The episode with the guy and his dog, The Hunt, they said hell in there. They said hell a couple of times in there. So I guess later on.
As long as
you're
talking about a place called hell and they're not telling somebody to go to hell. There's a difference between
the two. I guess they made their.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They definitely. Yeah. They definitely use euphemisms in that episode. Robert's already mentioned Logan's Run and 1984 and Soylent Green. A couple of more titles. I've just been looking at a list of dystopian films. So these are not just from memory, but there's THX 1138. That's Spielberg's first film. The Matrix, of course. A Woody Allen one, Sleeper. Well, of course, that was a comic take on it. More recently, V from Vendetta. Then you've got things like Blade Runner, Brazil, Escape from New York, The Handmaid's Tale, The Island, Children of Men, The Running Man, Aeon Flux, and Battle Royale. So it has been an absolute goldmine for science fiction and speculative fiction, this idea of this dystopian future. And I think it was a very good little, almost a vignette, really. It's not really a long story, as Bobby said. I mean, you certainly couldn't have stretched this out many more than 25 minutes, I don't think, but it fitted superbly well. I think the fact that we had the chap, the administrator, as it were, being let out. When I watched it the first time, I thought, why is he letting him out? You know, and the bomb goes off and you think he's safe. But, of course, that's all to set up the twist at the end, because you think, you know, the Burgess Meredith character has decided, you know, I'm not going to be nasty. I'm going to show compassion where you don't show compassion. And he lets him out. But, of course, he doesn't escape punishment because the state then turns on him. So I thought that was just a nice little switcheroo on that. Again, Robert wanted me to mention a Doctor Who episode, and the Sunmakers, I suppose, is the most likely one to mention. I won't go into the synopsis here. What I think I'll do is just drop it in the URL, but if you put Doctor Who, the Sunmakers, in Google and add the word wiki, you'll find it. But this is a very... It's in the far future. The planet Pluto is habitable. Well, you can tell when this was written. Pluto's not a planet any longer, but never mind. Heated by several miniature suns. But it's the whole ruling... Sorry. However, heat is available only to the ruling classes, the working population being oppressed by the ruthless, a bureaucratic and omnipresent company. And, of course, it's all about the taxes they have to pay and economic units and so on. But I think this is a vein of science fiction that comes back and back again, because you can examine trends about societies and how they lurch towards this totalitarianism where you're basically just a unit in the state. On a very, very small scale, here in the UK, they've just been having a little debate about liberal freedoms, and without going into the whole debate, but the government want to make it illegal for people to smoke in their own cars. The reason being that if children are exposed to smoke in their own cars, it's much more noxious in the constricted space of a car. But there's no way to sort of do that without just making a blanket ban on people smoking in cars. Now, here in the UK, the smokers, and I'm not a smoker, but have been hounded out of all buildings and so on. And the only place that people can actually smoke now is sort of away from buildings in the open air, are in the privacy of their own home. And the whole, and I don't want to get political here, but the point is I'm trying to make is that, you know, society can get, your rights can get chipped away in very small amounts. And the civil liberties people are saying, you know, inside your car, you're in your own home. And the government is trying to tell you what you can do in your own home. And of course, there's the counter argument that they're trying to protect children. But it's one of the people on the panel that was listening to a debate about this said the trouble is with these things that a society can sleepwalk into a totalitarian thingy simply by giving away rights. And so these are very real issues. And I think science fiction is exactly the place where you can explore these, because you're far enough away from them to be actually able to watch it and think, well, that's not right, this is not right, and judge it on those grounds. So it's a morality
tale. That's really interesting, Dave, because I think I had heard something like that a few years back where, I don't know if it was England, I don't know if it was the U.S., but they were trying to ban smoking in cars if you did have children. And I forget where it was, but it never passed because people said, this is my car. This is almost like, you know, when you own a home, you can do whatever you want in your home. This is my car. I own my car. I can do what I want in my car. It never got passed. And I can see that point. I mean, yeah, I see that they're trying to protect the children, but it's your car. You pay thousands and thousands of dollars for your car. It belongs to you. You should not be able to tell a person what they can and can't do in their car. I mean, outside of doing something lewd and lascivious, you know. I mean, you know, if you want to smoke in your car, that should be your own privilege.
Well, two things. The thing is, of course, that people who don't have any children or the children have grown up, they're the only person.
Exactly.
in the car. But the other one, and I don't really want to take us off topic too much here, but the other one that's just been proposed is that cameras should be fitted in all taxi cabs. And not only should they be fitted in, but they should, whatever goes on in the taxi should be recorded all the time, just in case somebody breaks the law. So that means there's a supposition of guilt. Every time you get in a taxi, it's assumed that you're going to do something you're not supposed to. Presumed innocent goes out the window. But again, people in the room may or may not disagree with these. The point I'm trying to make is that people, either in fiction or in real life, it's worthwhile examining these points. Whether you then vote for them or not, that's not the point. The point is, what you don't want is that, 20 years down the line, you wake up and suddenly you feel you are in a Big Brother society and you've sleptwalked into it. And I think sometimes programs like The Twilight Zone can examine these issues without people getting too, hot under the collar about it. Anyway,
I think that's the point that you bring up about The Twilight Zone, why people enjoy The Twilight Zone so much is also it's a reflection of society with some of these episodes, because a lot of stuff seem to either have part or are taking form in reality today. Patriot Act is a good example of that after September 11th. Why people enjoy these episodes, these society episodes, because they kind of mirror about what's going on in reality.
Yeah, I mean, one basic tenet of science fiction has long been, when you're talking about future societies, you take a particular trend that's happening all around you, and then you push it to an extreme but possible logical conclusion, and then you see it. I mean, the Children of Men one I mentioned, the film. I mean, that's where it's not something that we're doing on purpose, but they keep talking about the fertility of humans going down and down, probably because of all these hormones introduced into, chickens, and it gets into the water table and it starts affecting, fertility. And 20, 30 years down the line, it's not a question of you can't have more than two children. People can't get pregnant. That's the other idea behind The Handmaid's Tale, where they take on a woman to hire to be a childbearer for a rich couple. But
I'm
anyway,
so glad
that's
you mentioned that book. That's one of my all-time favorite books, Handmaid's Tale. Margaret Atwood.
Right.
Margaret Atwood wrote that. Yeah, I love that book. I love all of her books, but that one's one of my favorites.
Right. But, I think it's a pretty good episode to end the series on. And I think, like Robert, I'm also looking forward to Series 3. And no doubt, as we wrap up in a minute, you'll be telling everybody the episode title of the first one. But it has Charles Bronson in there. I've said that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, just so people know that we read what they write in the chat room, Steve Law, you were talking about, how they were banning...
Yeah.
Want to ban cigarettes in the car, and he said, Steve just said that there was the same opposition to seatbelts in cars, and now everyone seems happy to use them, which is true. At one time, before seatbelts were mandatory in cars, there were people who did not want seatbelts in their cars. They felt they didn't need them, they were too restricting. Well, now they're mandatory in all cars, but nobody seems to have a problem with them anymore.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm not saying one judgment is right and one judgment is wrong. I'm just thinking, if you don't engage in these decision making things, before you know it, these things are decided. That's why young people really need to get a little bit more political in their lives. I think so many people think, oh, it's not relevant to me, but of course, in the long run, it's. I mean, people in this room that are. Over 30 will know that, just look 10 years ago, society, what you can and can't do and what's considered normal and acceptable behaviour has changed. Mostly, I would agree, for the good. But it doesn't mean that you can't, take yourself out of this process. It's an ongoing process. And a very nice way of examining these things is in this type of series. And more than that, we're looking here, we're literally talking about an episode, right? The Obsolete Man, when did it air? It aired on the 2nd of June, 1961. It aired, 50 years ago. It's as relevant today as when it was made then. So that should give it a high rating above anything else.
Exactly. And your rating is a classic? Give it a classic rating?
It's up there. It's maybe four and a half. I just felt as though it was slightly... it seemed to me as though it was slightly low on budget. I think the lighting effect, although I admired it and it was very effective, was almost there to disguise that was just a great big plank of plywood, that table that Robert was going on about.
Well, the lighting, you're right. This was an excellent episode to be in black and white to give that ominous type of effect that, you know, almost like the dankness and dreariness of the time and to give that ominous feeling. I think, you know, this is a perfect black and white episode, and the setting was perfect. It was low budget. I mean, you see his room. I mean, this little room, you know, everything's just thrown around. I mean, it's not like this beautiful apartment that he lives in. He's got all his books thrown around. But it seemed like in that society, in that time period that he was living in, nobody had much of anything.
Yeah,
all the luxuries were taken away.
Yeah, one last thing I thought was absolutely great. I don't know if it was intended to be humorous, but the way he showed he was a rebel, mm-hmm. he wore a cardigan. You know, everybody else is sort of semi-military, and so what does he do? He wears a cardigan to show that he's an individual.
That's true. That's true. I didn't even think of that. You're right. You are right. Okay, well, I think it's kind of unanimous. This is like between a 4 and a 5 for everybody. Everybody's, you know, pretty happy. It's between excellent and classic. And, it was one of the best of the series. And there's no doubt about that. And Burgess Meredith, incomparable actor, absolutely fabulous. As, you know, I just can't dislike anything that he's in. And even Mr. Dingle the Strong, as terrible as that is, I can't hate it. I can't hate it because he was in it. I didn't give it a high rating or anything, but it's just, I can't hate anything but the Burgess Meredith is in. If it was somebody else had been in that episode, I would have given it a 0 or a 1. But, this episode is absolutely phenomenal. So, with that, we will just say that this is one of the all-time best. So our next show will be on Saturday, December 3rd, and that's 2 weeks from now. And we will begin Season 3 with the episode titled... Yeah, with the episode titled 2, starring two wonderful actors, Charles Bronson and Elizabeth Montgomery, before they were... really, really, really well known, and very good episode. And I'm hoping that everyone will be here for that. Again, that is on Saturday, December 3rd, 2 weeks from now, the beginning of Season 3, Robert's favorite season. So we will get started on that in a couple of weeks. So I do want to wish everyone a very happy Thanksgiving. I hope you have a wonderful holiday and eat yourselves into oblivion. All kinds of turkey bird and stuffing and all kinds of desserts. And, you know, Bobby and I will be doing the same. Right, Bobby?
That's all I wait for all year.
That's right. Yes, your Thanksgiving dinner and your Christmas dinner. Exactly.
That's it.
Get the pumpkin pie and all that good stuff. Yeah.
Oh, I'm
yeah.
making pumpkin pie. I'm making a sour cream apple pie. I'm making my wonderful sweet potato casserole. I'm just so excited. So, I'm going out shopping and buy all my stuff tomorrow. So I hope everyone has a wonderful holiday weekend. And we'll see you in 2 weeks. So thanks, everybody, for being here. See you 2 weeks from now. Bye.
Each summer, we take this occasion to celebrate a seminal event in American history.
This year, we depict perhaps the most important day in our shared past, the first Thanksgiving.
A day for maize, the Native American word for corn, a terrific turkey dinner, and brotherhood. So, white meat and dark meat, take it away!